16, and before we get there, let's another reminder of our April memory verse, which is then we'll see the significance of the fulfillment of this. In particular, I think the exchange in Luke 16 that Jesus has with the Pharisees, I will raise up a prophet like you from among your brethren, and will put my words in his mouth, and he will speak to them all that I command him. And significance of our earlier memory verses, all of which come from the Old Testament, right, is Jesus' point, which we'll see emphasized in this chapter. You search the scriptures, he'll say later, and they speak of me, right? So all of these promises, these prophetic utterances, the people to whom Jesus was teaching and preaching had these, right? So Luke 12, you can discern the signs of the seasons. Why can't you discern the signs of the times? Okay, so back to Luke 16. James finished his prayer quite aptly because even more focused this chapter about Christian living, the kingdom, where your priorities should be. So, fourth of these parables, right? Parable of the lost sheep, parable of lost coin, parable of the lost son. I'm going to get you to start saying that about the parable of the prodigal son. And now the parable of the shrewd manager. So your headings probably say dishonest manager. Think of it shrewd manager, and I think that will be helpful. So before we get into that, let's sort of set the context again. Right, we did that at the beginning of these parables about who the audience was, right? Beginning Luke 15, 1 through 3, Spirit through Luke says that Jesus is speaking to a group of Pharisees and tax collectors and sinners. So that's the audience that he has. The Pharisees speak against him, that you receive tax collectors and sinners and eat with them. And then Jesus gives these four. We saw three last week. Four parables to his audience. All right, so setting our discussion of the parable of the shrewd manager, because it's kind of a curious parable, right? A little more challenging to think about. Each of these parables, who do you think they're principally directed to? Sons. Why don't we make that plural? Okay. So the parable of lost sheep, probably principally directed to, I think, the Pharisees. Secondarily, the tax collectors and sinners. They're listening, right? And I think same with the parable of the lost coin, right? Let's just put sinners in quotes, because I think it's used rhetorically in that way, and then same. So secondarily, these groups, the parable of the lost son, the elder son, the younger son. I think both audiences for different purposes, right? And we saw that last week, right? The situation of the lost son is really telling these people who are coming to Jesus, recognizing who they are, how the Father views them, right? The parable is as much, if not more, about the Father and how he receives his sons than the sons themselves. And all of these parables are to the Pharisees, particularly the conclusion of the parable of the sons and the father with the elder son, right? How you need the heart of the Father towards these, quote, sinners who you won't receive and eat with, is how I would sum up all four of these. All right, and now the last one, it's different because I think there's a shift in focus in this, and I think this is really to his disciples, and when I say that, don't just mean the 12, but living as his disciple. So, kind of a progression through these. sheep wanders off, the shepherd goes and saves the sheep. So, and then celebrates. So it's the shepherd's desire to save the sheep, and how much rejoicing there is when the sheep is saved. Coin is lost. Woman finds the coin and celebrates. So being lost, that image of wandering away, being lost, being redeemed. Sheep and the coin obviously have no personalities. They don't do anything, but they do. We see from the parable of the sons that inherently part of this rescue and redemption is repentance, because we see the young son who wanders off, comes to himself, repents of it, is humbled before his father, and then, of course, we see the image of the father. And so there's sort of a progression here, at least I see, of being lost, being rescued, redeemed, repentance, and now having been restored, because that's where we see the young son, right? He puts the ring on him, gives him the robe, they celebrate, he's restored back into the family. Now, how you are to live. Anyway, that's sort of how I think all of these fit together. Point being, this parable of the shrewd manager is not just, oh, forget about what just I said, now we're going to talk about a dishonest manager. It has, it fits the context. Wait. Right. Right. 16:1, he also said to the disciples. And I promise we'll actually look at the parable of the shrewd manager. He said it's a somewhat challenging parable on its face. Important to keep in mind, again, what are parables? They're not allegories. They are common, everyday stories that lay beside, not on top of, lay beside the spiritual. And so, what is the principle occurring in this ordinary common event? And how does that principle then apply over here to the spiritual life that's laid beside? Again, not on top of, so it's not like for like. You don't look and say, oh, well, here's a shrewd manager. The shrewd manager must be this, and then the father. And I mean, some are closer, right, to the spiritual than others. So maybe some are like this parallel and some are like that parallel with the parable of the prodigal son. And as I mentioned, important not to read too much, not to think we have to fit every element of a parable into some spiritual application, because again, they're laying it beside one another to give principles. Okay, so just kind of setting that context, we have the parable of the, the ESV has the heading, dishonest manager, but as I mentioned, if you look at it, Jesus uses the term shrewd to describe him. So the event is this wealthy man has a manager, is told by others that at least the impression is the manager is fleecing him, maybe skimming off the top. And, you know, that sort of shows maybe the rich man isn't that attentive to his thing, to his goods, but that's, we don't see that applied as a principle, but so I don't think we have to apply that to anything. But in any event, he's going to replace the manager, and we see the manager's response, essentially looks at the situation, realizes, I have no way to care for myself, so I'm going to figure out a way to take care of myself. We see what he does, brings in these debtors who basically collude with him to cut their debts. The owner, I guess, doesn't know what anyone owes him. Yes, doesn't have very good books or doesn't have books that he controls. And so the manager takes care of himself. The owner learns of this and commends him for his shrewdness, right? And then Jesus says, and I tell you, I'm sorry, the master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends of yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. One who is faithful in a very little is faithful in much. One who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. So, again, on its face, it's like cheating, dishonest manager, cheat some more to take care of himself. How can we take anything good out of this, right? All right. But as I said, he's actually described as shrewd. So if you just look from that standpoint, and this Greek word also can mean wise, but shrewd is a more morally neutral term, right? Wise, we necessarily think, is like a good thing. So he's shrewd. So how is he shrewd in responding to the, and it can also mean prudent, in responding to the situation he was in, and how determined was he in doing that? Right? Again, recognizing this is over here, right? So this is just the worldly story over here. Spiritual reality is laying beside it. He was, right, he basically did what was necessary to take care of himself, right? Again, we're not, this is not something where that's established as a virtue. It's what's he doing? And Jesus says he's commended for his shrewdness because the people of the world, sons of the world, are more shrewd than the sons of the kingdom, right? And he was persistent, right? He brings in multiple debtors to do this. So I think, you know, that's more of what we're taking out of this. What did he recognize about his situation, how he acted to address it, how he was persistent in doing so. So Jesus gives three different lessons out of this, I think, from verses 8 through 12. So just verse 8, which I read, where he Jesus said that he was commended because the sons of the world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. So, taking this sort of persistent, I think that says three. I'm not sure why it says three. This is two. Anyway. Oh, no, we are on three. I apologize. Okay. So, looking at that idea of prudence, persistence, how can Christians or should, and because he's talking to his disciples, right, he'd earlier when he sent them out said, be wise as serpents, harmless as doves. So in your judgment and perception of others in the situation you're in, be wise as a serpent. And in your actions towards those others or in reacting to that situation, be harmless as a dove. Or as the Apostle Paul would say, as much as it lies in you, be at peace with all men. Spirit would say through Paul, right? Okay, so how should Christians have the type of prudence this shrewd manager showed when we're living as disciples? Yes, Tony.
And all of that, you know. So heart is where your treasure is, and the store of treasures in heaven, you know, and all of that. I was like, okay, I think I'm starting to understand it a little bit, you know, more. You know, it's not just about, you know, money or, you know, that. It's much bigger than that, you know.
Well, and these are given together, right? I don't mean to break them up. We're taking them in turn, but obviously Jesus gives all of this together. So this shrewdness is not separated from what he then says about the kingdom and about true riches, right? Okay. Because what we see with this shrewd manager, recognizes the situation, has a goal, acts to achieve that goal. That's what he does, right? We're not. And so then, in terms of the living that Christ is encouraging, telling his disciples to have, he doesn't mean, you know, cheat and all that, right? He means be wise, prudent. See what your purpose is. What is your goal? You're living for the kingdom. Live persistently to and orient what you do with the goal of achieving that purpose, right? That's higher spiritual purpose of living for the kingdom. Way.
I think the prudence and truth is accepting reality. Right. Being honest about the situation. So your stewardship is coming to an end. Period.
Right.
You can't dig because you're old and whatever, right? And you're too proud to take all, right? So for whatever, it doesn't mean he's a good person, but he's
right. Yeah, this is another parable that shows the very sort of practical, realistic view of the world and the human situation that underlies Jesus' teaching. So, you know, again, we don't make too much of what is coming out of this parable. The idea is you recognize your situation and you act to achieve your goal and you're persistent in it. But what is that goal? That goal, as he then goes on to say, right, is true riches, the kingdom, and to serve your true master, but with the same sort of prudence and persistence that we see this shrewd manager have. But he doesn't stop there, right? So again, we want to take the complete context of all of his teachings together. He then says, verse 9, and this is maybe the most challenging of these, right, is make friends of yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. Now, the they may not be the friends. That's sort of what it implies. But he's still talking about an attitude towards money, right? How are you using wealth? So What if you're going to quote unquote make friends, right? What attitude towards money and others do you need to have? What's money to you then, right? Because we've already seen, right, Luke 12, the unwise man, unwise owner for whom money was the end in itself. I'm going to build bigger barns and I'm going to sit back and be happy with all my wealth. And Jesus says, you fool. Today your soul will be accounted for you, right? So he's already taught that in the past, Tony.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm.
That you need to make friends unrighteous mammon, so that when I fail, when I have a problem, they'll take care of me. And then, verses 10 and on, is where it's saying, okay, now I'm going to give you a shift in thinking. That's the way the world thinks. That's the way the Pharisees think. This is the way you need to think. You need to realize your master expects you to be faithful in all things. And if you're not going to show faithfulness here in these small things, why in the world is it going to give you better things?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it can be read that way too, because like the way it's set out, 1 through 9 are all one paragraph, and then 10, they frequently might be set out as a different paragraph. So it could be a shift in the thinking from, all right, just if you're thinking as a worldly person, let me put in, this is what you would do, but this is how you ought to be thinking. Yeah, that could be true too. At a minimum, if you are making friends with the wealth is not the end in itself. You're using it for another purpose, right? Even if that's what he means, you're still using it for a purpose other than just the money itself, right? It's not your master, he'll say, verse 12. Stephen. Yeah, that could be. Yeah, that could be. And certainly, as we see in the next one, he sums this up with a very direct application to the spiritual mind, right? The spiritual goals, the spiritual purpose. All right, so then, as Tony pointed out, 10 through 13, Jesus then turns to the idea of being a faithful servant, what can be entrusted to a servant, how you must be faithful in all things, right? And then, who is your master? And because you can't serve two masters, right? So, let me erase it so we can have more room. So, what principles do you take from that instruction in 10 through 13 about living as a disciple? Because I think that's where he's coming to his, very pointed teaching and relating in this this parable. Certainly the overall is you have to be faithful, right? In what? And he gives this comparison in little and much. Right? Maybe this up here is easier. Right? Little scope is narrower, easier to figure out how to deal with it. If you're not faithful in what is little, how will you be entrusted or faithful in what is much? And then others in your own. And it seems the point of this, Jesus with his disciples, he has a mission and purpose for them, right? They're going to go out and they're going to teach his gospel to others. And he says, if you're not faithful in what is another's, who will give you that which is your own? Right? Wait. Right? And that's right. I mean, the point of this, you see this parable, he's using someone else, he's dishonest in it. And Jesus says, I think his tone says, you shift. So, but you be faithful in all things that are given to you. There are things that are given to us that are narrower, right, that are easier to recognize, maybe how I should use this, whether it's goods or time or what have you. And we need to be faithful in those things that we can be faithful in the greater things, right? And all of these things are given by the Master. And ultimately, right, you can't serve them both. So it isn't even that which should be more important, right? Worldly things can't even be equal, right? He says you can't serve two masters. It's not one above the other, right? You can't even view them equally, right? That's just not the nature of how we work as human beings. So God is our master, right? And so then all of these goods are used for the purpose of, as Jesus says, serving God. You cannot serve God and money. You can use money to serve God, just like that shrewd servant used money to care for himself, right? So that's prudence. That's just wisdom. This money is just a worldly tool. It's not a spiritual. There's no spiritual significance to money, right? You cannot have it and live as this faithful servant, faithful in all things, and faithful in the greater things, and faithful in others, and receive your own without money. If you have money, then you use it for the same purpose, right? So I think what we take from this is the importance that whatever is entrusted to us, right, is given to us to achieve God's purposes, to serve our Master, to be faithful in His things, and then to be blessed with those things that are ours. And to whatever extent He chooses to do that in the world, we know what He will give in the heavenly kingdom, right? He's going to give the blessings of fellowship and forgiveness with Him. And we can't be worldly and godly, right? That you can't, they can't even be equal, much less obviously, the worldly above the spiritual, like that foolish owner, right? We can't even be equal. God has to be first place, and everything else is used for the purpose of serving that Master. Yes, Clayton. Right.
So that doesn't apply to me. But there are other wealth vectors or wealth indicators. Maybe there isn't a lot of treasure, but how are we using our time? Are we faithful with our time? Are we faithful with whatever talents? Are we putting those
Yep, very good. Okay, so then let's move to what the reaction of the Pharisees is, right? So how did the Pharisees react to these four parables? Right? Oh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Well, certainly so.
But that's
yep.
And that their
right, which is they ridicule it, right? And ridicule isn't even just who is this person think he is, or how do you lecture me? It's that what you're saying is ridiculous, right? That they're ridiculing not just his presumption, they might, because they've said that elsewhere, like who are you to do this or say this, without really challenging what he did or said, right? Well, you're not the one who can say this. Here, they're just ridiculing even what he said, Tony. And absolutely, I mean, his point is saying, here's what it actually means to have God as your master, as opposed to money as your master. And as Tony pointed out, the Spirit says the Pharisees were lovers of money. And so they ridiculed him. And then Jesus rebukes them, right, beginning in verse 15. So what is Jesus' rebuke to them? Right. And, of course, seeing that at the beginning with their attitude towards those who were coming to Jesus, and they're rejecting them. Jesus says, you are those who justify yourselves, but God knows your heart. So, I mean, you think about the futility of that. What's the point of justifying yourself? You're not going to change God's mind. You're not going to trick him. You're not going to persuade him. Oh, you're right. So all of that, like, ungodly and uncharitable spirit and actions that you do, oh, really? Oh, now I understand. Well, I agree. Well, no, we don't get to persuade and change God's mind and matters of sin and salvation like that. And so talk about a useless action that they're doing. Yes, Tony. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Those things the world considers important and highly esteemed, don't you fall into that same trap. Because those things are an abomination to God. You can't serve those things. You need to serve God and think the way He thinks.
Yeah, I think that's certainly where he is with the Pharisees. You esteem things that God rejects, right? Which, you know, you can see it elsewhere. I mean, last week with James, right? That God rejects the proud and gives grace to the humble. So, and then he continues, right? The law and the prophets were until John. Since then, the good news of the kingdom of God is preached, and everyone forces his way into it, meaning seeks it, does what's necessary to obtain it. There's other parables that illustrate that, but it's easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one dot of the law to become void. And so, you know, it seems to me so that's Jesus' rebuke of them. As Tony said, it concludes with, you're justifying yourself. God rejects what you value and what you're exalting. Instead, implicit, right? He wants you to exalt what he values and what he exalts. And then he gives this principle about the law and the revelation, right? And I think this is going again, you've been taught this, so you can know this from what's already been given, right? It's another example where Jesus isn't giving new things. He is reminding people of what has been given by God throughout the time of the law and the prophets. So so what's the principle that he gives about God's revelation, his law and revelation in this? Right. It's not going to pass away, and it's not going to change. And I think, you know, that's the point, right? The Pharisees were always trying to present Jesus as if he's giving something new, he's violating the law, right? And Jesus' point again and again is, no, you don't understand the law and the prophets. You ignore what the teachings are, and then he gives the correct and true teaching. And his, you know, as talked about, I think the point of giving this at the end is everything I've told you, you can see in the law and the prophets. That God is to be your master, you can see in the law and the prophets. That you can't love money instead of God is given before, right? Whether by example of people who were destroyed because of it, or God's express teachings through the law and the prophets. This is how God has always wanted his people to live. This has always been the measure of faithful living. And you know, I think the point in verse 18 about divorce and adultery is just to illustrate that fixed, unchangeable nature of God's law, right? Because over in Matthew 19, Jesus says, from the beginning, right? So this is like the fundamental teaching that illustrates what Jesus has said about the law and the prophets. It hasn't changed. It's been consistent. It's not going to pass away in terms of God's expectations of his people. Live faithful to the commands I've given you. Live faithful to what I've told you I want my people to live. Be faithful in the things that I give you. Right? That's always been from the beginning. And it hasn't changed. And that's true. Go back to Genesis 2, and what did Adam do? He cared for the garden. God gave him the garden, and he was faithful in doing so. So the idea of being faithful in whatever God gives you, whether it's little or much, has been true from the beginning. And so I think that's why Jesus uses this principle about marriage to illustrate what he said about the law. And the point is, that's true today, right? God's word hasn't changed. God's nature is eternal. This isn't the God of the Old Testament, the God of the New Testament, whatever cliches we hear people say. He is God. He's been the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, right? And just as the nature of the revelation that Jesus was using to correct these Pharisees, these religious leaders, remains true today for us. So Jesus has this rebuke of the Pharisees, right? And we've answered all this. Okay, and then follows up with this account, right, of the rich man and Lazarus. Names Lazarus, doesn't name the rich man. Lazarus's name means whom God helps. And it's a derivation of Eliezer, which you'll see various people called that in the past. And this is probably familiar to us, right, that he recounts the lives of these rich men. Lazarus lays at the gate of the rich man. And, you know, the man at the pool of Siloam, who Jesus heals, he was laid there every day by his friends, right? Acts 3, Peter heals the man who lays at the gate beautiful. So maybe Lazarus was also lame, and that's why he was laying. I think the point of this is Lazarus' need was obvious. Just like the parable of the Good Samaritan, the man in need there, it was obvious the man needed need. There was no need for like ethical discernment and moral judgment and do I need to help this person and it's a complicated situation. It's not a complicated situation, right? The rich man, of course, doesn't do that. And then Jesus recounts they both die and what is their condition in the spiritual realm, right? So just quickly, I think there is some building in what he said before. How did this rich man's life measure against the instructions Jesus gave to his disciples in 9 through 13? Right? Didn't measure up. Worldly thinking. His wealth was his end. He took comfort in his wealth. He didn't use it for the greater purpose of serving God that Jesus recounts, right? He just serves himself. So, the rich man doesn't at all fulfill what Jesus said those who serve God are doing. He had the kind of, you know, worldly and self-serving attitude that the Pharisees did. He was a lover of money, is how he's presented, right? And then, right, so the rich man is in torment and he appeals to Abraham. And remember, Jesus would later, when he's in Jerusalem, say that God is not the God of the dead, but the living. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so the point being, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are still alive there because God is God of the living. So the rich man's in torment. He appeals to Abraham, right? Send Lazarus to me to give me relief. And send him to my brothers. And Abraham answers him, right? Abraham says two things. One, he can't come to you, right? Because there's a great gulf fixed between you and him. And that sort of illustrates the two masters, right? That you're in the world, and money and God aren't like, there isn't a literal great gulf fixed in it. But spiritually, there is, right? Spiritually, you can't serve two masters. You can't serve God and money. Those two things are separated, right? So he can't come to you. There's a great gulf fixed. And what? As to your brothers, if they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead. So, let's just put both these up because we're getting close to the end. So how are Jesus' statement about the law and the prophets echoed in what Abraham tells this rich man who's in torment? Right? His point is, it's already been revealed to you what God's will for your life is. Right? God has... God's already revealed it. He's already told you all that, as Peter would say decades later, all things that are needed for life and godliness, right? So if you listen to Moses and the prophets, you'll understand what God desires and you won't wind up, they won't wind up with you in torment, right? They'll live as Jesus has just said, live with God as their master. The point there to the Pharisees, God's already spoken through Moses and the prophets, right? You need to hear him. And then the last point about they won't hear even if one rises from the dead. Well, did they? No, they didn't. Right? That's the point, is that I think we take from it, Jesus is saying again, I'm not bringing anything new, I'm fulfilling. Right? I'm that prophet of Deuteronomy 18. I'm coming in fulfillment of all the laws and the prophets. So if you listen to Moses and the prophets, you'll know who I am, you'll listen to me, and you will react to me the way you should react to me. So, again, less to us, all that is needed to be given, God has given, and ultimately fulfilled in Jesus and his revelation of God in the flesh, and all of his teaching, and of course his atoning work on the cross. And he is risen, so more emphatic that we can not only be persuaded by Moses and the prophets, we can be persuaded by the fact that Jesus has risen from the dead. All right, well, we'll finish there. We'll turn to Luke 17 next week and teachings about temptation. Thanks very much.